Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. We are at the top of the hour, and this is Jim Pickett with the International Rectal Microbicide Advocates. You have dialed in and logged on to our Lube Safety webinar called The Latest on Lab Tests, Lube Monkeys, and Lube Using Humans that we are doing in collaboration with the wonderful folks at AVAC. Julian from AVAC is still handling some logistics on the back end of this webinar. We're calling in a number of people, and that does take a few moments. So we'll be starting shortly. Everyone is on a global mute, so we are recording this call, and we have a global mute to make sure that the call is nice and clean. We will be taking questions. You can pose questions in the chat function. If you are logged in on the webinar, if you are just listening to the call and you're following along with the slides that were posted to the IRMA website, you can send an email with your question to rectalmicro@gmail.com. So you can email questions to rectalmicro@gmail.com, or you can wait until we take pauses during the webinar, and we can ask you to unmute your phone and ask your question verbally. So when those times come, we will, request folks who want to ask a question verbally to do so. In the meantime, thanks for being here right on time and early. We will be getting started in just a few moments. Okay, I've just gotten word that we have pretty much everyone dialed in. So thanks everyone for being here this morning, afternoon, / evening. We have a really great webinar planned for you today with four presentations covering the gamut from lab science to advocacy in the field to behavioral science. So we have a lot to cover. Each of our wonderful presenters will be talking for about 10 minutes. We'll be taking clarifying questions after each presentation, and then we'll open it up to discussion for the remainder of our call. We expect the call to take 60 minutes. And again, in terms of asking questions, you can send those to rectalmicro@gmail.com. You can pose questions in the chat, and we will keep track of those. And you can also ask questions verbally, and we'll remind you how to unmute your phone when the time comes, so you can ask that verbally. As a reminder, we are recording the call. A recording of the call will be made available soon after this webinar is finished, and you'll get a link to that in an email because you have registered. So without further ado, I should just really, again, thank AVAC for all their support in helping us pull this off. So thank you, AVAC, and especially Julian, who does most of the heavy lifting and all the logistics stuff on these calls. So our first presenter this morning is from the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the United States. It's Ellen Kirsch, who is a microbiologist and a member of the preclinical evaluation team, Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention at the CDC. She's going to be talking to us about a very interesting rectal challenge study done in monkeys using a hyperosmolar lube. So without further ado, Ellen, if you'd like to unmute yourself and go ahead and get started.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
So good morning, and thank you, Jim, for the invitation to present our work. Slide two, please. All right, so the goal of our studies was to determine whether a commercially available lubricant causes cytotoxicity in the rectum and whether this increases HIV risk. We used an animal model and the macaque form of HIV, simian HIV, to study this. Our study design was as follows. We had a store-bought lubricant, and it had the following chemical properties: an osmolality of 8,064 milliosmoles per kg, a pH of 4, and it had polyquaternium. Some of these chemical properties have previously been hypothesized to cause damage to rectal tissues. So our studies were performed in two phases. Phase one was we performed a cytotoxicity evaluation and then moved on to phase two, where we looked at CHIP infection risk. So in summary, we used animals to study whether the lubricant caused damage and whether this would put the animals at risk for infection. Slide three, please. So this slide shows how we designed our phase one study at the tissue damage. Our goals were to see whether this animal model would be helpful, whether we would be able to document any damage in the form of inflammation or bleeding or any tissue changes. And we also wanted to find out the time course of such effects. So the schematic on here shows the timeline in which the experiments were done. It was a 6-week study, and the lube application is shown with these rounded symbols. And it was done twice per week on the consecutive days. The triangles indicate when we took biological samples. They were taken right before each lube use to see if there was any long-lasting damage from the previous lube application. And then we also took these triangles indicate samples we took right after lube application at different times, ranging from 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 2 hours, and so forth. So occasionally we also took biopsies. Next slide, please.
Hi, Ellen.
Yes?
Can I just have you pause for a second? There's a lot of noise coming from your line, so I don't know if there's people rustling around, but if you could try to keep it at a minimum so it's easier to hear. Thank you.
Okay. So slide four is a results slide where we're reporting that we found inflammation that peaked 30 minutes after lube use. I'm showing one example of a cytokine, IL-6, which is evidence for inflammation. We measured this factor after animals were treated either with control buffer on the left here or with lubricant. Only the time points immediately after lube application are shown. What you can see here is that there was an upregulation of this factor, first at 15 minutes and more so at 30 minutes. After that, the inflammation subsided. Not shown are the week-over-week time points where we did not find any upregulation of this factor. So to sum up this technical slide, we did find inflammation after lubricant use. It peaked at 30 minutes. Other cytokines were also induced, and we have presented a detailed analysis of this before at the CROI conference. Slide five, please. We had other results, and they're summarized here. We looked at tissue sloughing or peeling. An example is shown at the, in the photographs on the bottom here. They were taken under a microscope of rectal washes, so they showed tissue pieces. When control buffer was applied, there were small tissue pieces, and this is normal. But after lubricant use, these tissue pieces were larger and sometimes associated with blood. We did not find a change in PA and no change in bacteria in the rectum. And the biopsies showed some infiltration with inflammatory cells after 30 minutes, but it was mild. And 7 days after lubricant application, the biopsies showed healing. So to summarize the cytotoxicity or tissue damage work, We did find evidence of some damage by the lube. It occurred quickly after lube use and did not last for days or longer. Slide 6, please. So with these results in hand, we next wanted to determine whether infection risk was higher after lube use at a time point when we knew there was inflammation, so we picked 30 minutes. We designed this study phase as follows. We compared infection risk in 21 animals divided into two groups, the lube or control buffer group. And we varied virus doses and measured the virus dose where 50% of the animals would become infected. It's also called the AID50, animal infectious dose. So in scientific terms, our hypothesis was that less virus would be needed to infect lube-treated animals compared to controls because they may be more vulnerable. So the study design was to start exposing animals at low dose. If they did not become infected, then repeat the exposures at higher dose until we recorded infection. The slide also shows the timeline. We kept the 6-week study design and did repeated lube application. So in the 3rd week, we exposed 30 minutes after the last lubricant application using a virus termed SHIV-SF162P3. We then continued to apply the lube and measured whether this would change the infection course and also shedding of virus. Slide 7, please. So this slide shows our main results. So it shows the different virus doses that we used to expose the animals, ranging at the bottom from 1.25 tissue culture doses all the way up to 25,000. So each animal got a different amount of virus, but the same amount of lubricant or buffer. A plus on this slide means that the animal was exposed and indeed became infected, and a minus means that the animal was exposed but did not become infected. So in all, we performed 62 exposures and recorded 17 infections. In the middle are the buffer-treated animals. You can see a dose effect of the virus, meaning that at increasing doses, more animals became infected. And with these data, our statistician determined that the virus dose needed to infect buffer-treated animals was 1,721 tissue culture doses. On the right are the lube-treated animals, and for them, the animal infectious dose was higher. It was close to 200,000 doses. The difference was not statistically significant, as indicated here by a p-value of 0.4. So against our expectations, lube-treated animals did not need less virus to become infected, so they were not more vulnerable to infection. Again, to summarize this, we did not find evidence that lube treatment made the animals more vulnerable to infection. Next slide, please. We also looked at effect of continued lube treatment and how that would affect infection course. Sorry. On the left here, we're looking at how much virus was found in the blood after infection. And there was no statistically significant difference between the control and lube-treated animals. In addition, we looked at virus shedding in the rectum. Shedding can be a measure of infectivity to others. There was not a difference in how much virus was shed in the rectum when we compared the two groups. Next slide, please. So this is a summary slide. So we tested one hyperosmolar low pH lubricant in an animal model, and it caused short-lived rectal cytotoxicity, also called inflammation. When we tested whether this treatment caused an increase in infection risk, we found this was not so. Our study had limitations. Since so far we have only tested one product, others may behave differently. And we only used a non-traumatic way to apply the lube in this animal model. Also, animal models for increased risk testing have limits in sensitivity. Next slide, please. So this is our discussion and future direction slide. So our results were unexpected. When we saw rectal cytotoxicity, we expected that the infection risk would be higher after lube treatment, but we did not find this to be the case. So it is possible that the damage heals very quickly and is not sufficient to affect the infection risk. More data could further clarify this and also real-world effects of lube use. And in summary, we plan to evaluate additional lubricants in additional cytotoxicity and risk model analyses. Slide 11, please. Thank you. So I would like to warmly thank my coworkers listed here, all from CDC except for Dorothy Patton from the University of Washington. In particular, I'd like to thank Ajay Vishwanathan, who performed the lab work, and Rich Walitsky and Janet McNichol for reviewing the slides and making suggestions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen, for a really nice, succinct presentation. It was excellent. We do have a moment or two for some clarifying questions. There is a clarifying question that came in on the chat. I'm not sure if you're able to answer this directly or not, Ellen, but let us know. Can you tell us the name brand of the lube that was used?
Yeah, we had an internal decision here at CDC not to do that because we are worried to just single out one manufacturer. We think this is not warranted yet since we've only tested one product and so far. However, we have listed the chemical properties in the presentation, so that information is available.
And I think just for clarification, whether we know the name of the lube or not, water-based lubes are hyperosmolar, and water-based lubes are commonly used in condom distribution programs, and they're condom compatible. There's varying ranges of hyperosmolarity, and the lube you guys used was at the higher end. Is that correct, Ellen?
That's very correct, and we base our studies on a scientific publication by Begay et al., and this lubricant was described in there and had these chemical properties listed there, and it was the highest osmolality lubricant listed, and that's why we picked it.
Great. We have a couple more questions in the chat, and then we'll take them briefly and then move forward. One of our listeners mentions the fact that the last several of your slides mention non-traumatic application. So how might these findings be different, in your opinion, if intercourse were simulated in addition to the lube just applied? And he gave a little paren saying he isn't implying that intercourse necessarily is traumatic.
Yeah, so it's a complicated answer. It could go either way. So there could be traumatic tissue damage during intercourse, not necessarily, but it's possible. So lubricant may increase the damage that is done then. However, lubricant is also protective of damage during intercourse. So it's a paradoxical effect of lubricant, and we were not able to evaluate this in an animal model where, traumatic or simulation of traumatic sex acts is not ethical, so we cannot test that in animals.
Can you just explain briefly how lube is applied non-traumatically? So in the study, how was lube applied in the monkeys?
Yes, so we gently infused it using a very soft gastric feeding tube. So that's a very soft plastic, and it's a small tube that is stuck into the rectum. And then the 3 milliliters of the lubricant were gently pushed out of a syringe and infused into the rectum. And then we took an additional 2 milliliters of lubricant and swabbed the external anal area as well.
Thank you. And then the final clarifying question that we'll move on, and of course, everybody, Ellen will remain with us at the end, and more questions are, of course, warmly welcome. I know that this work was presented in a poster at CROI, but we have a caller wondering if the research has been published, and if so, is there a citation you can share?
We have a manuscript in preparation that is not published yet and not submitted yet, but we hope to submit it soon. So the CROI abstract is the only thing that's accessible right now outside of this presentation.
Yes. And for people on the call, that poster was made available to you through the registration process for this call. So thank you for those great questions. Thank you, Ellen, and thanks for hanging around until the end when we'll likely have more. I'd now like to invite Kevin Reedy to speak. He is the medical director at the Health for Men Project at the Annova Health Institute in South Africa, and he has done some really interesting published work on commonly used lubricants in South Africa. So, Kevin, if you could unmute your phone and get started, that would be great.
Great. Thank you, Jim. And thank you once again for the opportunity to present on one of the MSMGF webinars. So I'm going to be talking about a study we did down here in Cape Town looking at hyperosmolar lubricants. And I'm going to ask to move straight to the second slide, please. So the context of this study is that lubricant forms part of the HIV prevention toolkit for men who have sex with men. But this causes some problems for us because lubricant safety really hasn't been adequately studied across the board, and there are many questions that still remain. And we're left in a position that we, as either suppliers of lubricant in our programs or as gay men and users of lubricants in the rectum, we're doing so without being able to fully assess the safety of those products. Next slide, please. The situation in South Africa is that until fairly recently, probably within the last 2 years, there hasn't been any lubricant available through the state healthcare sector anyway. And in fact, there have only been limited condom choices available. The Department of Health distributes a brand of condom called the Choice Condom, which we often referred to as the no-choice condom because it's a one-size-fits-all. And that condom was not distributed with any lubricants. That's changing, and we are now seeing public health recommendations being made that lubricants should be delivered. But, of course, this is being made in the absence of the safety data that we're really looking for. Another problem that we see happening with lubricants is that the messaging to promote lubricant use is very heteronormative. Now, what that means is that the promoters regard heterosexual sex as the only normal activity, and all the imagery and messaging that you see about lubricants is to promote it for penile vaginal sex, and its use for anal sex is tacitly regarded as abnormal. Next slide, please. On this slide, I've just picked a few examples from the internet showing you what I'm on about, and you can see in these types of messaging that it's very female orientated, or rather heterosexually sex orientated. And in the next slide, I'm going to show you a couple of examples of what would be considered non-heteronormative messaging, where all sex would be regarded, all consensual sex would be regarded as normal without any moral judgment. So these two posters are posters that were designed for a shebeen or a pub or tavern based communication project, and they're particularly neutral. They really speak to anybody who's having sex and could benefit from using lube. Next slide, please. So this slide I actually put up in jest, but it just reinforces that even when we start talking about anal sex, a lot of people will presume that that's men and women only, whereas, of course, from our perspective, we're thinking about anybody with a rectum who's having sex. We should be marketing lube to them. Next slide, please. So why do a lube study down here on the tip of Africa? Well, one of the reasons is that there really isn't any regional data from Africa, and there's very little awareness of lubricant safety issues. On the other side of the coin, we have the fact that NGOs are now active in key population health, and they're creating demand for both condom and lubricant provision. We've also found in our training of healthcare providers that there's a complete lack of awareness, of provider awareness, of how one might go about assessing lubricant safety for people's programs. Next slide, please. At the end of the day, we really were after an accessible piece of information that would be easily available to local healthcare providers, and that junior doctors and nurses specifically might read. We wanted to raise awareness of the issue of osmolality, which has just been discussed in the previous talk. And that's really for non-profit organizations, Department of Health, who may be tendering for lubricant, and, of course, the end users of lube, people having sex. In the bottom right-hand corner of that slide is the SABS mark, the South African Bureau of Standards. And it's quite interesting that most of the lubricants sold in this country carry this mark, but yet no testing of osmolality or rectal toxicity is required by the South African Bureau of Standards. So this is misleading for users of lube who believe the product has been tested and stamped as safe. It isn't. All right, next slide. So just to get down to exactly what we did, is we procured a variety of different lubricants from Adult World. Adult World is the largest sex shop franchise in South Africa. We specifically chose a Cape Town city-based store. In fact, the store we chose is opposite the medical school at the University of Cape Town. The store reports high numbers of men and men having sex with men among their clientele. And the store actually does include on-site video booths and sex on-site cubicles. Obviously, we were trying to find a representative sample of lubes that are used by men who have sex with men for anal sex, rather than a store perhaps that was selling mainly to heterosexual men. And we purchased the best-selling brands of lube. And next slide, please. We then took that lubricant off to the University of Cape Town Division of Chemical Pathology, and the lubricant there was screened for osmolality and for its glycerol content. Can we move to the next slide, please? So in addition to the lubricants that we bought at Adult World, we also analyzed some common food-based lubricant substitutes. So these are products, usually food-based products, that our clients at our clinics tell us that they're using in place of lube when they're unable to access lube. So we analyzed low-fat plain yogurt and also egg albumin along with our range of lubricants. Next slide, please. My next slide is actually stolen from Mark, and I just wanted to pause for a moment and discuss the concept of what osmolality is for people that are not aware of this. So hyperosmolar substances would be substances that tend to draw water into themselves and will relatively dehydrate the surrounding tissue. So if we think of the picture of the grapes there, if they are hyperosmolar, they will draw water into the grape through the skin and swell those grapes up. If you look at the raisin, and we take that as an example of something that is hypoosmolar, that would tend to lose water to the surrounding tissues. The substance itself would dehydrate, but it might swell the cells of the surrounding tissues. Now, hyperosmolar lube, if they dehydrate surrounding cells by drawing water out of them, the postulate is that they may open spaces between those cells through which HIV could enter into the body. Next slide, please. This is the main slide of our study results. As you can see, there's a whole range of different lubricants listed on that, and a whole different range of osmolalities was found among these products. The highest of all was an osmolality recorded with 9,440 milliosmoles per kilo. And just by way of comparison, human plasma osmolality is about 280 milliosmoles per liter. And really, that would be the kind of range perhaps that the ideal lubricant should be targeted at. I put a circle around the lube that is distributed by the Health for Men project, which is an MSM-targeted sexual health service in Cape Town. That was towards the lower end of the osmolality scale, but still much higher than plasma osmolality. The safest lube that we found in the sample that we analyzed was leather personal lubricant, which seemed really good from an osmolality point of view, but not everybody wants their lube smelling of leather. And the food products that we looked at had very low osmolalities and potentially would not damage the rectum from an osmolality perspective. However, we are very aware that in Africa, where food insecurity is a problem, food products are eaten and not likely to be used for sex. And then lastly, at the bottom of that list is semen, which has an osmolality of 340 milliosmoles per liter, but clearly we're not recommending anybody use that as a lubricant. And next slide, please. So the article showing these results has been published. It's got a very long and unsexy title, and it appeared in the South African Medical Journal in October 2013. The hypertext link is included there on the slide, and it's an article that's freely available for download. What we found is that most of the lubricants we assayed, 88% of them, were hyperosmolar, but some lubricants were far better than others. And not a single one of the lubricant products assayed said anything about osmolality or glycerol content on the packaging, which means that we as end users really don't have any information from the manufacturers that allows us to assess safety. We certainly found that food products have low osmolality and could potentially be used, bearing in mind the problems that I've already mentioned. Next slide, please. So what do we think should happen after all of this? Well, local awareness in Africa and other developing nations about lube safety really needs to be increased. There are good examples already of MSM-targeted information education and communication materials. It's probably not necessary to reinvent the wheel. I think online one could find a lot of access to these kinds of products, but their distribution has been very suboptimal in Africa. We think it's a good message that to put out there that lubricants really should be used together with condoms. There's always been a debate over if you're not going to use a condom, is it better to use a lubricant to reduce friction? And that was asked in a question after the last talk. But we think, bearing in mind the lack of ability to assess safety at this point, our message should be that they should be used together. If they're not going to be, and if one has a choice of lubricant, then it probably makes sense to use or to choose a low osmolality product. But again, many people don't have any choice in that matter. For those that do, low osmolality may very well be better. Last slide, please. So at the end of the day, that's all very nice, but so what? We certainly didn't prove that hyperosmolar lubricants are toxic if they're used anally. We haven't proved that they increase HIV if they're used in the rectum. I think what we have done is to put osmolality on the map. We got great exposure. And certainly I have seen tenders now from the Department of Health in South Africa and other non-governmental organizations providing MSM healthcare, and their tender documents and specifications certainly do now address lubricant, as well as a host of other lubricant safety issues. And I'm going to end there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kevin, for another excellent presentation. Thank you so much. There is a clarifying question or a question in the chat from Anna wondering, or she's curious as to why you didn't test cooking oil or other forms of grease, because in the United States, these are some of the most common food items that are used as lubricants. Is that not the case in South Africa?
The information really came back via our outreach educators and our peer educators and from support groups. So we simply tested what was being reported to us. And I don't think there was a choice not to test cooking oil. It actually just didn't come up. So, you know, I don't know how representative that is of what people are really using out there. I imagine everything is being used, from hand lotion to cooking oil to the things we tested. It's a limitation of our study.
Thanks, Kevin. And going back to your great slide describing osmolarity using a grape and a raisin, I think this is still a confusing concept for some folks, and I know there's some questions that have come in. If you could just kind of think about that again, say that again, maybe in a slightly different way to help people understand what exactly you mean with those images.
Sure. Osmolality really relates to how many particles are dissolved within a substance. So the classic example is to go back to school biology and look at a cup of water in which you dissolve sugar. The more sugar that is dissolved into that liquid, the more hyperosmolar it will be, because the more sugar molecules there are in suspension. So if something has a lot of molecules in suspension, those molecules tend to draw water towards them. And in the grape example, what that would tend to do would be to draw water from the surroundings through the skin of the grape into the grape, and therefore make those grapes look swollen as they are in the picture. But obviously the water that's being drawn into the grapes is being drawn from the surrounding tissue. I mean, I don't think we put grapes in the rectum, but it would draw water out of the cells of the rectum and into the grape. And that's a hyperosmolar product. So a hyperosmolar lube has a lot of molecules within it that will tend to draw water into the lube. The lubricant would tend to swell slightly and may become more runny, but the water would be coming from the surrounding environment, and therefore the cells around that lubricant would dry up. And if they shrivel up, that may mean that they're not tightly aligned and that there are gaps in the mucosal surface. I hope that makes things a little clearer.
I think that was great, and if we need to come back to this question, we'll have time at the end. Finally, one last question, just regarding the use of yogurt.
Other than osmolarity, are there other considerations that someone might want to think about if they're going to use albumin or yogurt for a lubricant?
I think that that is a really important point. This study was a very limited piece of work, and it really only looked at glycerol and osmolality. And it may certainly be that both food products and lubricants, even if their osmolality is low, may contain other substances that are toxic to the lining of the rectum. And that is not something that we looked for at all. So we can really only comment on osmolality. But in reality, there's likely to be a whole range of factors that affect the safety of anything that you put into the rectal environment.
Thanks, Kevin. That was really fantastic. And thanks for sticking around until the end for final questions. We're now going to invite Pamina Gorbach to speak. She's a professor at the Department of Epidemiology at UCLA. She's got a very long title. I can't say all those words right now. We've long worked with Pamina and her group at UCLA, we meaning Irma, on various measures around lube safety, lube access, lube use. So we're really excited to have her once again come on and give us some new data on the use of rectal lubricants and incident STIs at a study conducted at a number of STD clinics in the United States. So, Pamina, take it away.
Okay. Hi. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right, so I'm going to present a study that we did have a poster at the ISSTDR conference last summer about, but it's not published. And it is because the findings we've been pounding on for a while, as you'll see, and are pretty interesting and not what we expected. So I'll be interested to hear what this group says. So the title of the talk is about, as Jim mentioned, lubricant use and incident STIs at 9 U.S. STD clinics. Next slide, please. So we can really skip this because we know, and everyone's given a great job, that lubricant use during receptive anal intercourse may affect the acquisition of rectally transmitted infections. So what I look at is the association between lubricant use STIs, but not HIV. So this is rectal gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis. And so we assess the association between lube use during receptive anal intercourse and the acquisition of these STIs among HIV negative men of sex with men attending STD clinics in the U.S. So the data here were collected as part of Project AWARE, which is a large randomized controlled trial of HIV testing and counseling conducted at 9 U.S. clinics. So what this was this was an intervention study, a behavioral intervention study, that was funded, I think, by NIDA, that Lisa Metch and Grant Colfax were the PIs of. And the study had already started when we released our findings from the first lube study we did that showed an association between lube use and STIs. So the PIs contacted me and asked me if I wanted to see if I could add a study of lubricants into their ongoing study. So we did, but that because we did it ongoing, it affected our design a little bit. We added a measure of lubricant use at the six-month visit. All participants in the study were enrolled, had a baseline questionnaire done, were tested for STIs, and then 6 months later were seen again. And that's where we did a web-based survey on lube use that was completed separately by the participants. And that was done in addition to their large ACASI of behavioral risk. They were all tested for rectal chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, and actually HIV and other STIs that we didn't include at this six-month visit. We then conducted multivariable logistic regression to examine the association between the rectal STIs and syphilis at that six-month visit and the frequency of lubricant use reported during that past month and the types of lubricants used most often during RAI in the past month. Next slide, please. I'll let my dog out of my office. Okay, so in the results, of the MSM that we enrolled in Project AWARE who completed their six-month visit, there were 951. Of those, there were 572, or 60%, who were HIV negative and reported having RAI in the past month. of these men, so that's of the 572, 12.6 were diagnosed with a rectal STI at that visit. In the past 6 months, these men reported a mean of 6.2 anal intercourse partners and 2.6 partners with whom condoms were not used during AI. In the prior month, men reported using lube during a mean of 82% of REI acts and condoms during a mean of 54% of REI acts. And if you can see, the median was 100% and the median was
67%. Amina?
Sorry?
Amina, can you please speak closer to either your speakerphone or actually use your phone? Some of our listeners are having a hard time hearing you. You're fading in and out at times.
Okay, sure. Let me think about that. That'll help. Okay.
That's so much better. Thank you.
Okay. So next slide. So these are our findings. So these are the characteristics of the men the enrolled in Project AWARE who reported RAI during the past month by their STI diagnosis at that same visit. So the first column is those who did not have a rectal STI, and the far right two columns are the N and then the percent of those who reported an STI or who were tested positive for an STI. And so, as you can see, we see the typical pattern, which is that we have a higher prevalence of STIs among younger men, particularly those in the 18 to 24-year-old group. In fact, almost half of the STIs were in that group. And I want to point out that when we look, got down to the over 35s, while we have 8% prevalence, which is significant, the numbers were pretty small. We only had 6 in that group. We did see a difference by education. The stars indicate there was a statistical significant difference between education or between those without STIs and those with STIs. Employment, we also saw a difference. Ecstasy use, interesting, for drug use. We looked at quite a few drugs, and ecstasy and crack cocaine were those that were associated with having an STI. And, again, age seen as mean age here, as well as by age group. Next slide, please. So then we looked at the lubricant use. So here are the lubricants that were reported. So since we had done another study where we asked about lubricant use, we were particularly interested in the types of lubes used here in the U.S. These were, again, 9 STD clinics distributed throughout the United States that included places like Florida and South Carolina, as well as San Francisco and Seattle and Los Angeles. And these were the most common. What we did in this is we looked at that time at what were the lubes available on the market commercially and made a chart which had an image of the bottle that each lube was shown in that was laminated and available for all participants to use. And we had over 100 lubes on that chart. And participants looked at the chart and then were able to not just have to remember the name of the lube but make sure they recognized the bottle, because we had been told that many folks just remember what the bottle looks like and don't remember the exact name. And it gets complicated because there's, as you can see, lots of different wet platinum, wet original. The companies make different one company like ID Glide or Wet will produce a number of different products in KY. So these are the ones that were reported, the top 10, and the percents that they were reported. So as you can see, the top one is ID Glide. And then when it says type, that's whether it was a water-based or a silicone-based type. Okay, next slide, please. So this is what we found in terms of the association between lubricant use, and this was if they reported that they always used or they sometimes or never used in the past month. And we used this measure because it's the same one we used in our previous study, so we wanted to see if we were going to replicate our findings. And here what we did was we divided it by age group. So in the far left is whether or not lubricant use was associated with STIs among the youngest that were 18 to 24. So the blue bars are those that did not have an STI by lube use, and the red bars are whether they did have an STI. So if you see for the youngest guys, actually there were more STIs among those who were not using lube. And if you looked, which suggests maybe a protective effect, and if you look at the middle ages,
there was not much of a difference, but as they got older, the relationship flipped so that those who always used lube who were older had more STIs that were incident. And that's the case for the 30 to 34-year-olds and especially for those over 35. And next slide, please. So then we looked at the factors associated with having an STI diagnosis in this. And to summarize, this is our multivariable analysis. So that means that we took what you just saw, which was that raw association between an STI and lubricant use, and we put it in a big model. And we controlled for things like site, because we had different lubricant patterns by places like Los Angeles versus Florida, and so we wanted to make sure that it wasn't a side effect. We controlled for substance use, and we controlled for the number of REI acts with condom use, so that was exposed sex, and that was over the last month, and having HSV2 at baseline, because that we thought might compromise the rectum. So when we put these all in the model at the same time, we found that the following things were still associated with having an STI, and that was high school education, so that if you were more educated, you were less likely to have an STI, the number of partners that you had in the last 6 months, so just total exposure, and then this age and lubricant association that I showed you in that chart continued and was pretty strong, although the confidence intervals got very wide because our numbers get really small for the older guys, which means that within those age groups, there was an association between lubricant use and the STI. So it is protective, which means that for the younger guys who have an STI, there's an association with lubricant use that they're less likely to have an STI if they use lube often or always. And for the older guys, looks like it increases their risk for having an STI. And again, the confidence intervals get wide, but that's because the numbers of STIs for the older men became much smaller. Next slide, please. So this is then a model that shows, and I'm sorry to show you the whole table, but I'll walk you through it. Between lube used most often during REI in the past month, and in this model what we did was we looked at the types of lube used, not just the frequency. So here, the unadjusted model is just a simple bivariate relationship between the lube use and the variables listed on the left. And in the adjusted, the far right column, that's a multivariable model that puts all those factors in at once. If the yellow lines are those that are significant. So what you see is that we still see age, so that younger age is associated with having an STI. And we see education is still in there. And then we see the number of partners is still in there. So that's the same relationships. But what we found then, if you look at the lube type, was that the silicone-based lubes were associated with having an STI, not the other types of lubes, including water-based lubes. And so the silicone lubes were both associated at a bivariate level and at a multivariable level as well. And those confidence intervals are actually pretty nice and tight, which suggests that this relationship is pretty resilient. So next slide, please. So what do we – the paper has not yet been published, or there is a draft. We have written it. And this is how we interpret these somewhat surprising findings. That this is the second study that we have done now that shows an association between rectal STIs, including syphilis and lubricant use for men who have sex with men. And in this study, by collecting more detailed data on lubricant use and focusing only on HIV-negative men and embedding our study in a larger prospective study, these results move our understanding of lubricant use and its relationship with RSTIs forward by identifying a type of lubricant that is associated with incident STIs and a variable pattern by age. Okay, next slide, please. So what do we think about this silicone rather surprising finding? We can first off say that there may be other behaviors that are confounding the relationship between the use of silicone-based lubricants and rectal STIs. that may be the case. As you saw in our multivariable models, we sort of controlled for the standard ones, but there may be some other things. And so we looked at, and I didn't have time to show you the table here, but we have a table that looks at who uses silicone lube more than other lubes. And significantly more men who use the silicone-based lubricants most often were those who also reported the use of some of the party drugs, particularly GHB, poppers, powdered cocaine, tranquilizers, barbiturates, prescription drugs, and Viagra. So these were not the the crack users, and so that was interesting that it was associated, though, with these party drugs. The multivariable models did not show an increased association that was significant between substance use and the STIs, but it was trending in the positive direction, and so this might have been significant with greater power. So there might be something that goes on during partying, or it means that it's not really that it's silicone, it's just that that's what you have to need to use in those events that's really what's causing the increased association with STIs. We could not test for an interaction between substance use and age to see if that's what's going on. It's the younger guys because we didn't have enough power. Silicone-based lubricants are known to have longer duration of activity than other types of lubricants, which could allow for longer duration of sex and or repeated sexual events while under the influence of substance use. And from our colleagues in the laboratories, particularly Charlene Desnudi, she told me that she has seen that silicone-based lubricants may adhere more to rectal tissue. So there are possible unmeasured effects that may also enhance the infectivity of STIs from silicone. Next slide, please. So the association we observe with age and lubricant use may also be explained by two factors. One, lubricant use may have a cumulative effect on the rectal epithelium such that it may take many applications and years of use to result in enhanced risk for STIs. And second, older men may have a thinner rectal epithelial cellular lining, which may result in more vulnerability and pliability than that of younger men, resulting in different lubricant absorption rates or enhanced sloughing of rectopithelial tissue during REI. So these are just conjectures, and future relationships and studies need to be studied. Next slide, please.
Thank you so much, Pumina. That was really that was your last slide. And that was excellent. We have time for two clarifying questions answered briefly, and we want to have time to hear from Marc-André around the efficacy response and what needs to happen. I hope since we started a few minutes late, we can all hang out for a few minutes past the hour. The first question is, in terms of the STI rates you talked about, do the STI rates include both symptomatic and asymptomatic STIs, and how were STIs screened for?
So these STIs are all STIs, symptomatic and asymptomatic. They were tested in the clinic, so they weren't screened. These were folks all in an intervention study. So they were using the standard test for STIs. I mean, I can go through each. You know, I think for gonorrhea and chlamydia, they used Aptima Combo 2, you know, blah, blah, blah. Syphilis was confirmed. These were active syphilis, so that was both RPR and TPPAH. So these are incident new cases of STIs at the six-month visit.
Well, and the final question, and see if you can answer this, and then we're going to move on to Marc-André and take everyone's questions at the end. So this is a statement and a question. Lube use had a protective effect, but does that mean that lubricant use itself was protective? Could it be that not using lubricant was harmful, or that not using lube, using spit instead, for example, is a marker that relates to the type of sex or choice of partners?
I think that's a great question, and I want to be clear that the findings do not say lube use is protective. The findings say for younger men, there was lower risk for STIs, for younger men only those in our youngest age group, which was under age 24. And so it could be that the kinds of sex they were having when they were not using lubes, you're right, is different and is less likely to result in an STI.
Thanks so much, Pumina. And Pumina will hang out for a second. We're going to go a few minutes after the hour so we have time to hear from Marc-André, our wonderful IRMA secretary and our resident lube guru. So, Marc-André, take it away, please.
Thank you, Jim. And thank you to the previous presenters. We can start right away on the next slide. I would just like to give you an idea of what IRMA and others are doing on lubricant safety, as well as provide some suggestions of what you can do. And I'll point out why we hope that 2014 is the year we make progress. So next slide. Let's start with a brief overview of what IRMA has been doing. Next slide. IRMA has made this issue a priority, and it's been a priority for us since IRMA was created 9 years ago. One of the first things we did was to conduct a global survey on lube use. We've created some materials to explain the issue of lubricant safety. We also created a global lube safety working group, which includes advocates, policymakers, and as far as we know, all the researchers in the world who've conducted studies on this topic. Last year, we issued a global call to action on lubricant safety, and we've developed a draft research agenda where we've tried to identify some priorities for the field. We've also been engaging, to some extent, with regulators and manufacturers, and obviously with researchers. And we've also been working hard on lubricant access. If you go to the IRMA blog, the address is at the top of the slide there, and click on the tab that's labeled Lube Safety, you'll find links to all of this information. Next slide. So first of all, just to talk about the large internet-based survey that IRMA conducted a few years ago, we had nearly 9,000 people from over 100 countries that answered the survey, which was available in multiple languages. We asked several questions in the survey, including what lubes people used when they had anal sex. The main findings were summarized back in 2008 in our report, then published in a journal in 2010. And to this day, a lot of researchers are still using our list of the most popular lubes used for anal sex as a basis for deciding which lubes to use in their studies, which is great since that was actually the main purpose for doing the study in the first place. So next slide. We've worked with several researchers to analyze the data, including Pamina's group at UCLA and others. They helped us analyze the overall findings, and we've worked with other colleagues for other types of analysis. We had over 900 women who responded to our survey, and that data was analyzed and presented at AIDS 2010. Data from Latin America has also been presented at an international conference, and all this information is available on the IRMA website or in previous webinars. And the qualitative data was presented at Microbicides 2012. Next slide. As I mentioned, we've developed materials to provide information on the research so far into lube safety, so I encourage you to check out the fact sheet and the more detailed Q&A that IRMA's produced. It's available on our website at directmicrobicides.org, and they're available in multiple languages thanks to the generosity of the Global Forum on MSM and HIV. Next slide. So we have our Global Lube Safety Working Group, which serves several functions. Through the working group, we facilitate dialogue among researchers and advocates, monitor the research on an ongoing basis, compile articles and studies related to lubricant safety, particularly for rectal use. As I mentioned, we've established contact with some regulators and manufacturers to get their perspectives. We make our list of the most widely used lubes available to anyone who's interested in testing lubes, trying to make decisions about which ones to test as a priority. We've been encouraging researchers to test lubes for rectal safety and share their findings, such as this call, and also identify further areas for research. So next slide. Last year, we issued a global call to action on lubricant safety. Over 500 organizations and individuals from all around the world signed on, including advocates, researchers, manufacturers. A link to the call to action was included in the email for this call. Next slide. The global call to action highlights the need for a lube safety research agenda, and we've developed such a draft research agenda with some of our key partners. It identifies what we believe to be some of the priorities, which includes the need to determine which tests should be used to assess the safety of lubes. So Kevin alluded to this in his presentation. It includes not just water-based lubes, but also silicone and oil-based lubes, which a lot of people use, especially when they don't use condoms, and our presentations today point out the importance of testing all of those. So they definitely should be a priority. We also need to determine which tests are needed to assess STI risk, as we've just heard. That's important as well, and not just HIV risk. Most studies so far, particularly the laboratory studies, have focused almost entirely on water-based lubes and mostly on HIV risk. So So once we know which tests to use, then we need to use them to test a lot more products than have been tested so far. There have been maybe 5 dozen products tested so far in the various studies that have been done, and many of them have only been tested in 1 or 2 studies or using just, you know, 1, 2, or 3 assays. We need more lab-based studies, obviously, but also more animal studies and, of course, studies in humans to determine if there's any real-world risk in humans. And I think the juxtaposition of the 3 presentations that we just heard illustrates the importance of having the full range of studies completed. So far, there's only been 1 study that's tested loop safety directly in humans. And we also need to take into account how people actually use loop. So there was a question about that after the last presentation. Do they mix them with other products like tap water? Well, yes, they do quite often. And how much do they use? How often do they reapply? And so these are just some of the questions that need answers and that we identified in our draft research agenda. Next slide. So I just wanted to mention that in addition to our work on loop safety, we've also been working on loop access, since in many parts of the world, people cannot access condom-compatible loops, as Kevin pointed out. Part of this work has been happening through Project ARM, or Africa for Rectal Microbicides, which is an initiative through which African advocates, researchers, and global allies have developed priority actions to ensure Africa fully engages in rectal microbicide research and advocacy activities, including the integration of safe for anal sex messaging into HIV prevention programs. One of the cornerstones of that initiative was the creation of the GLAM campaign, which stands for Global Lube Access Mobilization. We developed stickers with the tagline "and lube," meaning anytime you mention condoms, we should always say "and lube." Next slide. A toolkit focusing on Africa is available in French and English and proposes a host of ways lube access can be improved. Last year, 3 small grants were provided to advocates for improving lube access in 3 African countries, and another 7 new grants are being announced any day now. A version of this toolkit is also being developed for Latin America and the Caribbean and should be available in the coming months. Next slide. And what are others doing on the issue of lube safety? Well, 2 years ago, the World Health Organization, UNFPA, NFHI 360 issued an advisory note. It's aimed at member states who are considering bulk procuring lubes along with their male and female condoms. It's important to note that this is not guidance targeted to individuals, but to bulk procurers of these products. And the bottom line is that the WHO, UNFPA, FHI 360 say that lubes can be bulk procured, and they outline certain issues that member states should consider, such as compatibility with condoms, pH levels, osmolarity levels, etc. Next slide. In the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control created a time-limited internal working group that made internal recommendations based on their review of the existing data. And as we just heard, the CDC also conducted their own research as a result, including the monkey study that we just heard about from Ellen. The Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator, which is responsible for PEPFAR, has also looked at the issue of lubricant safety in the last couple of years. It issued a policy statement identifying the need for more research on lubricant safety. Next slide. So why do we hope that 2014 is the year we make progress on the issue of lubricant safety? Next slide. We think that we may have finally reached a critical mass of interest, attention, and concern for lubricant safety in 2004. Will we see progress based on this? We certainly hope so. The WHO has started a consultation process that will hopefully lead to a couple of formal literature reviews, of the available research in order to update its guidance from a couple of years ago. We know the CDC undertook some work that we've just heard described. PEPFAR has expressed its opinion about the need for more research. And we just heard about the results of a new study exploring the link between reported lube use and higher rates of rectal STIs. So IRMA certainly plans to leverage all of this interest from the 2 new study results that we just heard about today, the WHO process that's just started, work from the CDC, PEPFAR, in an effort to make some significant progress. Next slide. So how can you be a lube safety superheroine? Next slide. If you haven't done so already, please take a look at our materials, including our lube safety fact sheet and Q&A, which I mentioned earlier. We will likely be updating the fact sheet and Q&A this year in light of some of the most recent research. And obviously, we'll let everyone know when an updated version is available. You can listen to other recorded webinars we've done over the past few years. You can check out the GLAM toolkit and use it in your community. There are components that can be used no matter where you are, even though the toolkit was developed specifically for an African context. And all of these resources can be accessed on the IRMA website and on our blog page under the Lube Safety tab. Please share all of this information and these resources with colleagues, friends, funders, and researchers that you think might be interested in your network. And you're, of course, welcome to join our working group. Just send me a message, and I can add you. Next slide. And that's it. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much for that rapid-fire description of our amazing advocacy efforts on lube safety. And thanks to all of you for being here. By being on this call, you're voting in favor of lube safety advocacy, so thank you for that. We have time for a few questions. I have a few that were already queued up. I want to let you know that if we don't get to your questions, you can always email them to me, and I'll do my best to answer them, or I'll farm them up to the appropriate presenter. So there are still opportunities even after this call is done. I want to clarify how you can access the slides. All the slides are already available on the IRMA website. So if you go to the IRMA website and you click on the Resources tab, you'll pull up a menu where you can click on teleconferences. Boom, you click there. You'll see all the slides are already there. As soon as the recording is available, the audio recording, we will be including that link in that array of links around the slide. And also, everyone who registered for this call will be getting a follow-up email that will point people to these resources. So this webinar and these slides and the audio can be the gift that continues to give and give and give. So thank you for that. So a couple of clarifying questions or further questions for Pamina. So Pamina, get ready. Star 7, your phone. The first is a kind of a combination statement question. So this person says, I thought the cell thickness of the rectal epithelia was already about a cell layer thick. So how could it be less than that, and why would that change in older men? I don't really understand where the conjecture would be. Plus, I thought the epithelium auto-heals and auto-heals rapidly. So there's, you know, how did those facts and those perspectives fit in with what you were talking about, Pamina?
Okay. So this was something I talked about with some clinicians, and it's something that we would have to look at in some clinical studies a little bit better. But we know that, in general, tissue, as people age, becomes weaker and more pliable. And certainly there's been a tremendous amount of research on what's known as sort of vaginal loosening and changes in the vagina over time as women age. And I think that that research just hasn't been done as much for men. Regarding what goes on in the rectum with aging. But the clinicians that focus on rectal health that I've spoken to seem to think that there might be something going on that have to do with changes around age in the men. So like I said, these are conjectures that suggest that because we see this association for older men and it doesn't seem to be explained by differences in behavior, that we should look at physical differences in the rectum that may affect STI vulnerability. Because people, as we know, continue to have sex as they age, but their vulnerability to infection and other health issues change over time.
Thanks, Pamina. And here's another one for you. Just going back to the association with age, the caller, you know, doesn't really feel like the bar charts show a clear trend. And while there's some risk that shows with increased age, the confidence intervals are wide. So there's that just to put out there. And she's wondering, you know, in your opinion, how reliable is this interpretation of lube associated with increased risk for STI? How strong do you think this interpretation is?
Okay, so with age, so we've been looking at these data now for a while, I guess almost certainly more than a year, because I was so perplexed by this finding and uncomfortable with it. And so I can tell you that this association has been looked at with age in multiple ways. So it first came up by looking at differences between mean age and the standard deviations away from mean age. And then we looked at it by these age categories because we felt like that would be an easier way to interpret it. So the finding with age, as much as we pounded on it and looked at it in different ways, didn't go away. It's there. But I don't really know what it means. The wide confidence intervals I was very clear about, absolutely. And as I explained, and if you look earlier in it, we just don't have a lot of STIs among the older men. So that's a problem. You know, we don't really have enough power to do more in-depth analyses on this relationship because of the lack of power with the older men. And in all STI studies, you generally see this, that most of our STIs occur in the younger age group. So it's really hard to study this among older men because you have to get enough of them with STIs. You know, I haven't finished writing the paper. I'm working on it. I'm sure we'll get really interesting comments from reviewers. I feel like I have to share this data, though. I can't sit on it. That wouldn't be ethical either. But I don't really know what it means. All I can say is we see an association that has to do with increasing age and lubricant use. There are wide confidence intervals, but the association is there. So I'm sharing it with this group, who's sort of a friendly, interested audience, and I'm looking forward to other ideas. But like I said, I do think we will finish the manuscript and put it out there because, you know, it was a big study. It was probably the most rigorous study of this type that we've seen with incident STIs and more detailed data on lube use. So I feel like I have to publish the results, even if I don't really understand them.
Well, and I agree, Pamina. We want them published, and this is how research works, right? We're going to have to chew on it, figure it out, and answer all the questions that these new answers bring up for us. So we have one final question for Marc-André, and then we're going to call. We're going to end the call, and again, you know how to reach us if you want to. If your questions weren't answered, if questions you asked when you registered weren't appropriately covered, please let me know and we'll get them answered for you. The final question goes to Marc-André, and one of our listeners says, there's still a lot of oil-based substances in developing countries or being used for lubes. What is the current state of the knowledge on the safety of petroleum jellies, mineral oils, et cetera, when used without condoms? I think Marc-André could probably answer that, and if Kevin wants to jump in and answer or give a some feedback on that, that would be great.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And unfortunately, it's practically a data-free zone. We don't have a lot of information on oil-based products. As I mentioned, almost all of the products that have been tested, or the vast majority of the products that have been tested in the handful of studies that have been done so far, were on water-based lubricants. So we have some that have started to test silicone-based products, but there are far fewer in numbers. And oil-based products, to my knowledge, have almost never been included in these studies. And there are reasons for that. A lot of the studies so far have focused on commercially available lubricants. Kevin's study is one of the notable exceptions that has included some household products. But the other reason is similar to the one that explains why we have less data about silicone-based lubes. My understanding, I'm certainly not a researcher, and I don't work in a lab, but my understanding from my conversations with researchers is that a lot of the tests that are done to assess lubricants require the products to be water-soluble. And so that creates the problems with silicone or oil-based products. Some of the tests that have been done to assess the safety of water-based lubricants simply cannot be done. You know, physically using silicone or oil-based products. So you're left with a smaller range of tests that you can do using these products. So Unfortunately, up until now, we don't have very much data. But as I mentioned, and it's certainly something we highlight in our draft research agenda, we need to identify which tests tell us the information we need to know. We need to figure out how to test a broader range of products, including as a priority some of the oil-based products and silicone-based products that get used very frequently when people don't use condoms. And, of course, in terms of HIV risk, that's where the greatest risk is. I mean, from what we've heard from Pamina's study, with or without condoms, use of lubricant may be an issue regardless. But we certainly need to have a lot more data on oil-based products. Right now, we have practically none.
Thanks, Marc-André. Kevin, you want to get the last word?
Great, thank you. And I absolutely agree with Mark. We are working in a data-free zone, and we're really just trying to almost make best guesses here. I think one thing just to split out is there are really two issues about lubricant safety, and maybe we're sort of confusing them a little bit, is when we look at all these food-based products and the water-based products, they may be toxic to rectal tissue. But the one thing that we know that they probably don't do is to degrade condoms. So if they're used with condoms, they're going to provide lubricantability and probably wouldn't be increasing HIV risk or transmission risk. The oil-based products, well, we don't know what they do to the rectal lining, but we do know that they are not really good with condoms and that they do lead to degradation of the condoms. So that would be another issue just to put into the mix here as a last word.
Mm-hmm.
So, with that said, I realize we're quite a bit after the hour now. I want to thank all of our wonderful presenters, Ellen, Pamina, Kevin, and Marc-André. I want to thank all of you for being here. Please do send questions if you have any that we didn't answer, and I will triage them. Look for an email that will follow up and point you to the recording. You can see the slides right now again if you want on the IRMA website. We'll see you again. And again, thanks to Julian and AVAC for helping us pull all this together. Have a wonderful rest of your day, however long that day may last at this point. Take good care and goodbye.